Whoops. We are convened officially.
All right.
Very important topic this morning, sage grouse, and the looming potential, of course, for a listing. The potential for some very significant economic impacts as a result. I want to thank everyone who has showed up this morning, I want to assure you that we consider this to be a very important topic. And with that, I'd like to ask forward, please, Brett Brownscombe, and if there are others that are coming forward with you, would you please ask them to join you?
Chair Witt.
Good morning.
And, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity today to speak to you about the state sage-grouse planning effort. And for the record, my name is Brett Brownscombe with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, serving as acting interim deputy director. With me are Ron Anglin, our Wildlife Division Chief, and Dave Bedeau, who is one of our resident biologists and area experts. So what I wanted to do here is start with a video. The idea, I have Ron and Dave with me to, at this point in time, make me look smarter. I'm going to do a presentation that follows the video on the state sage-grouse plan. As substance experts in the biological arena, I wanted to be sure we had from the department Ron and Dave to talk about the department's programs and any detailed questions if they come up if needed. What I thought we'd do is start out with an overview after the video. The video, I think the one caveat I'd say on this is a segment, a 5 minute or so segment of a video that ran on Oregon Public Broadcasting, produced by the series Nature. So my only caveat on that is it's a nature video. A lot of the human color that's part of this sage-grouse story is not in this video, but they're in the room. They've come from long distances, and we'll be presenting real people in real person.
Very
this
good.
Video is very focused on just kind of a appetite whetter overview. So with that, I'll hit play and see what kind of mood the video sets.
On an icy plateau, a lone performer takes the stage. In a deep freeze with 40-mile-an-hour winds, he begins his ancient display. His plumage is designed to dazzle. Key to his success is to stand out in this vast expanse. His home is often called the Big Empty. But that couldn't be farther from the truth. Those who look closely will discover a landscape full of life. On this stage, the struggle for survival has played out for millions of years. But change is on the horizon, splintering what remains of the wilderness, forcing those who call this home to face an uncertain future. In this rugged landscape, life has found a way to thrive. Winter is over, but a final blizzard forces itself onto the first days of spring. The locals here are accustomed to extremes. They've adapted to survive where others cannot. One in particular, the greater sage grouse, is found nowhere else. Despite the late snow, the lone performer begins his spring ritual. Instinct tells him it's time. His story actually began 3 years ago with his father on a nearby stage. He's not alone. Males from across the range are arriving to spar for female attention. Their elaborate display has only one purpose: to pass on their genes to the next generation. But self-promotion on an open stage is risky. This is the heart of the West. An ecosystem that once stretched 500,000 square miles across North America. Today, only half of that remains. At altitudes above 3,000 feet, it's considered high desert, a place of scarce water. 60% of it comes from snow, and most of that is carried to outlying rivers. As the days lengthen, temperatures rise, and a transformation takes place. The melt reveals a sea of sage. Sage is the anchor of the high desert. Without it, the land would be a dust bowl. These twisted shrubs can live 140 years. Extending for hundreds of miles in every direction, they're the foundation of this wilderness. The wildlife here has evolved with the sage for over 2 million years.
So I thought this is a much longer overall video. I think it runs around 50 minutes, and it's on the OPB website if folks want to watch further. But what we were hoping to do today is really save as much time for some of the folks who have come to speak with you and have traveled often fairly far. So today here are Jeff Everett from the Fish and Wildlife Service, given that this issue is an Endangered Species Act issue. We're thankful for Jeff and being willing to come and speak on behalf of the Fish and Wildlife Service. We also have Judge Grasty from Harney County, Mary Sue Gould, and Carol Dunton from Harney County, who are here to speak on community and ranch and livestock-related perspectives, as well as Ray Sessler, president of the Oregon Cattlemen's Association, and others. On that panel, the panel after Jeff Everett, I'm hoping that Marianne Nash could also come up and create a snuggy dais up here and join that panel if possible. So what I wanted to do is just, we're going to try to cover a lot of material with presentations, not our presentation, but all panels told in around an hour and a half, and then save at least 30 minutes for questions and back and forth and dialogue. And that's how we've set it up, but Chair Wade, it's your committee, and anything goes, and we're ready,
Brett,
for it.
Thank you very, very much. Appreciate that, and if you will help stage manage this for us, I'd appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Absolutely. So what I'll do is go through a bit about Oregon sage grouse planning effort, and then turn it over to Jeff Everett, who will speak from the Fish and Wildlife Service's perspective. Then we'll have a panel from Harney County, followed by Judge Grasty from Harney County, and Rich Angstrom to speak about some of the economic interests and community interests. And then we'll round it out with some brief statements from Al Elkins with the Oregon Hunters Association and Amanda Rich from the Nature Conservancy to present, ideally, the full perspective of who's been engaged or a sample of who's been engaged in this conversation at the state end and why. So what I wanted to do here is just talk about, first, why do a plan? Why bother? Planning takes time, and there are multiple reasons. First is that in 2010, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service issued a warranted but precluded finding under the Federal Endangered Species Act for sage grouse. So essentially, the service has determined that the bird warrants protection and listing under the Endangered Species Act, and they did that 5 years ago. But it was precluded at that time for other reasons, not based on the biology or the science of the service's findings. And so we, as 11 Western states, have to essentially talk the Fish and Wildlife Service out of the finding they already made and present the case for why states have their game plans together in ways that will address threats that the service was concerned about when it issued this finding in 2010. So other reasons to do a plan is there's an entire ecosystem, and the video spoke to that, that is at risk related to habitat threats, and I'll get into those more in the presentation. Those include juniper encroachment, fire, wildfire, and annual invasive grasses. The bird is an indicator of ecosystem health. And all of the values tied to the vast, you know, one-third of Oregon and what you saw across the whole West there, whether they be social values, rural communities, namely, economic values that ranges from oil and gas in some parts of the bird range to more locally, livestock grazing, ranching, farming, renewable energy development, mining, and then environmental values tied to this. Not just the people who like to go watch birds, but there is a significant recreational hunting base tied to this habitat, not just for sage grouse, but species that also rely on the ecosystem like mule deer and antelope. So finally, you know, the first reason to the plan, 2010 listing or warranted but precluded finding, it's not the most appetizing. You know, it's nobody really likes to do something just because the feeling is, well, we got to do this or else, and everybody else is doing it in the 11 Western states, so we might as well join. These other reasons are really, regardless of what people say or think about the Endangered Species Act, there are real threats out there, and they're important to a variety of values, and there's a big opportunity in being proactive. All the interests at hand here want more certainty. They have, whether you're a rural community or an economic developer looking to plan a project, or you're somebody who wants to see mule deer habitat improve or sage grass habitat improve, you want more certainty that that's going to happen. A plan is a way to provide that, and some pathways that ensure rural economic vitality and economic development pathways and conservation enhancements. This is a world of limited money and time. And so what a plan can do is prioritize how limited money and time would be spent in the areas that get you the greatest return on investment. And the last point is, you know, on being proactive, and the opportunity around it is there are jobs in this. There are jobs directly related to addressing the habitat threats. And there's these investments that we're proposing to make as partners in this whole effort leverages other investments from the federal government and landowners, and you'll hear more about that. So what would a plan achieve? Our overall aim here is we're going to present with the state's plan the case of the Fish and Wildlife Service why a listing is not warranted, and that would be because Oregon has a legitimate plan in place that addresses the key threats to sage grouse, and puts populations on the trajectory towards recovery. This is also our path to achieving a sound pathway moving forward for rangeland health and the rural communities and the economic interests that are tied to rangeland health. So this is not simply about averting an ESA listing. This is about strategically addressing threats to habitat and rural communities and economic interests that are going to exist on the landscape regardless of Endangered Species Act considerations. Lastly, the plan would achieve an improved partnership for coordination, both with local communities and county governments and landowners, but also with the federal government. The majority of the habitat in Oregon and across the West for sagegrass is managed, owned by the public, managed by the federal government through the Bureau of Land Management. And there's a need for greater coordination and improved coordination. So some highlights of what's in the plan. Updates on the status and threats to sagegrass. Highlights of actions that have been taken since 2010. So what we wanted to be sure to do here is claim and assert why, since the decision was made in 2010, the warranted decision, what's happened in Oregon. What have partners on the ground, landowners, conservation NGOs, the federal agencies and state agencies, what's happened to improve things since 2010? And at this point in time, there's been a lot done, and we wanted to highlight that and highlight the credit that people deserve for taking action since 2010. So we're building on a 2011 conservation strategy that the department drafted. We're not starting from scratch. And we're setting forth conservation actions that get at a multiple, I'll get into these in a second, that get at reversing some of the threats, and the threats that have been highlighted in the Fish and Wildlife Service warranted but precluded finding. So this is about not just listing, but prioritizing in a return on investment smart way, local and statewide conservation actions, and providing certainty to address certain gaps that exist and opportunities. And that includes rulemaking. The state's engaged in rulemaking through the Land Conservation and Development Department related to our land use system and our partnership with counties around that land use system. And we're engaged in mitigation rules on the Fish and Wildlife Commission end. That was directed by House Bill 3086 in 2013. So there's some legislative history in directing this effort. Those mitigation rules are about also setting up a registry and a mitigation protocol, a habitat quantification tool, where the state can quantify the impacts and quantify the credits related to people doing work on the ground. Mitigation is something that, and through these rules, the Fish and Wildlife and the LCDC rules working together, this is about how do we provide opportunities for rural communities and development, but do it in a way that is based on science and based on a conservation framework. So decision support tools, management practices, these are also in the plan, and then a governance structure for implementing the plan, including adaptive management across land ownership boundaries, so working with the federal government, private landowners, state agencies, and non-governmental entities. This gets into, without getting into the guts and the details of the plan, identifying needed key research, responsible parties for carrying out conservation actions under the plan, timelines, and then monitoring and metrics so we know where we are and whether we're hitting our goals. And then there's the local role. The important part of this plan is we all sit here and we can do things related to funding and rulemaking, and agencies have their programs, but it takes people on the ground to implement them. And so these local implementation teams are where the rubber meets the road in a lot of cases on turning the plan into action and advancing agreements with landowners. There are other partnerships that do this, but we wanted to call out a structure for it. The plan's based on a core area approach to conservation. So this is important because what you have here, the red, is these are the core areas or what's been identified through mapping as, you know, the best of the best, the most important areas, if you're a sagegrass or care about sagegrass. And why this approach? It's generally because not all habitats created equal, and not all threats to habitat, or not all habitats equally at risk. So what this does is highlights the areas that would be prioritized for protection, and that roughly covers 90% of the breeding population in just 37% of the habitat. It also allows for a scientifically but economically viable path forward. So development happens, but it's directed or steered into areas that are less significant, so as to lessen the impacts, namely steering away from core areas without totally shutting down opportunities in them, but taking a directed approach to try to avoid the best of the best. The big three that I wanted to highlight in terms of threats to sagegrass in Oregon and across the Great Basin are wildfire, juniper encroachment, and invasive annual grasses. And what these arrows are intended to represent is they play off of one another and feed into one another. Fire suppressions led to more juniper encroachment. That said, more juniper encroachment leads to more intense fire. Annual grasses, invasive annual grasses, have also led to fires that spread faster and burn at a greater geography historically more resilient ecosystems. It feeds the fire cycle, but the fire cycle feeds the invasive grasses. Fire disturbs a lot of habitat. When the ground's bare, these invasives have the advantage in recolonizing the place first. So moving through these real quick, I wanted to highlight two things. Juniper and there's a lot more in the plan than this, but juniper and wildfire, two of the big threats, have some infrastructure and opportunities around them that I wanted to highlight. So Oregon Department of Forestry and the Rangeland Fire Protection Associations have a partnership that's been around since the 60s. There are now 20 or so of these associations across the range of the bird. These associations are generally local landowners who they ranch, they farm, they're in the rural communities, they know the land real well, but they have other things to do than fight fire. They are doing this because protecting habitat and fighting fire when it does come near them is in their economic best interest, but it's also an opportunity because it's in the habitat's best interest in this case. So there's a way to, Department of Forestry supports these associations with grants and equipment and training. We have a lot of volunteer firefighters, people doing this on their own dime and time. They have about 200 pieces of large, heavy equipment. We're looking to enhance that with certain budget moves. And they cover a lot of acreage. The last point here is these RFPAs don't just fight fire on their own private lands. They help the state out. So on DSL and isolated parks, Oregon Parks Department lands out in eastern Oregon, they support fire operations there. They also get onto federal land. And it's a relationship between the federal government and these local associations that often lead to really successful initial attack on keeping fires small, but also, more importantly, in some cases, how to pre-position and pre-position resources to address fire size and try to keep it out of certain areas. This is a map depicting where we have these associations across Oregon. Secondly, juniper removal. This is an issue that's been and is still a live conversation in the legislature. There are opportunities as well as when we characterize juniper encroachment as a threat, that sometimes masks the fact that there are opportunities around this, not just for habitat improvement, but in connecting with efforts in rural communities around juniper-related products, wood products. And, you know, we have the focused approach of this plan is not to throw money everywhere, but focus on phase one and phase two juniper. So these are when I say phase one, phase two, these are the junipers that have invaded habitat that's within 1 to 3 miles of a lek, sage-grouse lek. And these are the priority areas to really hit. It's sciences, you know, when the landscape is at anywhere around 4% and certainly above juniper invasion or encroachment, the bird leaves it. And there's also research that's out and emerging around percentages like that, albeit a little higher, still in the 10% range for annual grasses. So we know if we do nothing, the problem's going to get worse. If we do concerted investments in strategic ways and places, we can turn around habitat trends that are negative now, improve the bird, and also generate jobs and opportunities around business development related to wood products. I don't want to take too much time, but I wanted to highlight that. I wanted to highlight the governor's recommended budget investments. Without going into detail, the governor's budget, and this is carried over between administrations, is at the $4.5 million level. And it goes into, it's passed through a variety of agencies. There is some capacity for agencies to run new programs, such as the mitigation program and land use rules. But the bulk of the money, the large bulk of the money, is passed through money to deal with rangeland fire and enhancing the state's capacity to deal with the issue, juniper treatment, pre and post wildfire resilience, so reseeding after a fire and getting out and doing fire breaks or invasive weed treatments to improve the resilience of habitat to fire. So all these things, they're about rural economic development as much as they are about sage-grouse. We're characterizing, or the budget, I should say, is characterized in the sage-grouse and working lands investments. How Oregon's doing relative to other states who are faced with the same sage-grouse issue is generally not great. So Wyoming has invested $14 million, and that's not including personnel, staff time. And Nevada, $13.7 million is what the governor has proposed, and that relates to a couple different areas that are broken out here. Montana's at $12 million. And what I wanted to note about this is for a lot of these other states, Nevada and Oregon are very similar because of our shared geography in a lot of cases and sage-grouse habitat. But Wyoming and Montana, for example, they're dealing with oil and gas as the largest threat. Their actions are a lot of them aimed at things like acquisitions or conservation easements. And that may work for that threat, but here in the Great Basin and in Oregon, when you're dealing with wildfire, invasive annual grasses, and juniper, those threats don't lend themselves to regulation. They don't lend themselves to conservation easements, really, either. These are things that address, that demand investments in habitat actions on the ground and doing it at a sustained level, not just a one-point time, here's an easement, call it good. Doing that won't really address something like wildfire, invasives, or juniper. You've got to put work on the ground, and you've got to sustain it. So our actions are actually more costly, and we need some sustained sources of investment. We've got OEB has stepped up, and the board has, Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, has committed an additional $1 million to actions in sage-grouse habitat per year for the next 10 years. Ongoing ODFMW actions, we are doing a lot with the resources we have in staff, district biologists, LEC surveys annually, working with landowners, and other actions on the ground related to the bird. Sage-grouse initiative, this is Natural Resource Conservation Service. They've pumped a lot of money, federal money, farm bill money, into sage-grouse work in Oregon and other states, especially juniper. They're poised to continue to do that, but it's federal money. It demands a state match. And then what we'll get into a bit following me here is the Canada Conservation Agreements. When you see CCAA or CCA, these are agreements. CCAA is Canada Conservation Agreements with Assurances between the private sector landowners, ranchers, livestock producers, and the federal government, the Fish and Wildlife Service in this case, around taking actions that benefit habitat, but that also provide assurances to landowners that they'll be protected from Endangered Species Act liability. Landowners are stepping up and putting a lot of their own time and effort into these CCAAs, and it's a contribution that is really one to highlight, or should be highlighted, about what Oregon's doing. The last bit is House Bill 2171. This is the Wild Bird and Community Investment Act. It would bring $2 to $3 million a year into just sage-grouse funding for actions on the ground. This is the, you know, juniper, wildfire, invasives, habitat threat actions that improve habitat. It's a tax. It's an excise tax, but it's something where the nexus between what it would fund and the values of those paying the tax are fairly closely aligned, and it would bring people who don't hunt, don't fish, don't pay fees related to that, and they don't own land and manage habitat to provide benefits to the public. It would bring those people into the system of paying for and the opportunity to share in the responsibility to achieve good things here. So that's still out there, and it's something that the state could do. This is the last slide. Here's who's at the table. This is the SageCon partnership. This is not everybody. This is just a sample. The point here is this is the entity or the planning partnership that's brought together the state's planning effort, and that are all at the table because they all have an interest at stake. And it's the point here is it's a big table. It's a crowded table. It's a lot of different players from diverse backgrounds and interests. It's convened by the governor's office, but co-convened by the Bureau of Land Management and NRCS. And the reason for that is we can't do it alone. We need to coordinate better, especially with the BLM. And NRCS has a lot of dollars in Sagegrass Initiative and other funds and good working relationships with landowners, and we need to build on all that together. So all these entities have been at the table as part of the planning process. I'm going to stop there and turn it over and be prepared to come back for questions at the end. And thanks. I'm trying to keep it brief.
Thank you very, very much.
So I think the next panel is, or panelist, I suppose he'll be lonely up here, is Jeff Everett from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Okay, very good.
Do we want to ask each individual panel? Or?
I think the notion was that we were going to, if we could, save our questions, and then we can have a question period so that we can run through the great number of panelists.
Maybe a statement.
Okay, one statement, Vice Chair Krieger.
The best thing I heard is you got rid of the so-called term bird seed tax. That might help us move forward.
Well, I hope it helps. I mean, it really is about, it's not about a bird seed tax. It really is about how do we do something in the face of an urgent ESA listing? How do we support rural communities and bring investments that can do that and also help wild birds?
Might even be able to vote for that.
That'd be super.
Good morning, Chair, representatives. My name, for the record, is Jeff Everett. I am a wildlife biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service out of Portland. I've been with the Fish and Wildlife Service for about 15 years, and I am currently the sage grouse coordinator for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service here in Oregon.
Welcome to our committee, and thank you for your appearance.
Thank you. Couple of points I'd like to make. Brett did an excellent job summarizing the extraordinary, and I'd like to emphasize the extraordinary part of the effort that is taking place not only in Oregon but throughout the 11 western states that sage-grouse currently occupy. It's often been described as one of the largest challenges in front of the natural resource community and the federal agencies that manage the natural resources, as well as the highest priority within the Fish and Wildlife Service and to a very large extent the Department of Interior at the moment. The Fish and Wildlife Service originally found that the greater sage-grouse was not warranted for listing back in 2005, and then as Brett described, in 2010 they were warranted but precluded at that point by higher national priorities and some other things that the service had to deal with. The service was almost immediately sued as a result of that determination, and as a part of a court settlement, we are obligated to make a listing determination by December 30th of this year. The 2010 finding and the subsequent lawsuit and settlement has triggered a tremendous amount of activity. The greater sage-grouse population across the 11 western states can be roughly divided along the Continental Divide into two larger ecosystems. We, along with Idaho, Nevada, and California, and Washington to a lesser extent, are the bulk of what we call the Great Basin population. And the big threats to sage-grouse within the Great Basin population are wildfire and invasives. And as Brett described in that excellent slide, the two issues are interrelated. On the Rocky Mountain side, the issues are more tied to habitat fragmentation and disturbance. For what it's worth, sage-grouse are a relatively big bird, but they're extremely delicate. They can't handle a lot of pressure. If you push on them from a habitat alteration point of view through the wildfire and invasive cycles, they tend to stop using the habitat very quickly. Same thing when you apply fragmentation or disturbance to them. Just a little bit of fragmentation or disturbance, something like an oil and gas well sticking up on the horizon, is enough to keep them from using the habitat. And so that's what's led largely to the tremendous amount of shrinkage in the habitat over the last 80 to 100 years or so. Roughly half of what was out there still remains. And so on the Great Basin side, Oregon, along with our partner states through the Western Governors Association and through WAFWA and a variety of other things, are trying to implement these plans to address the threat and demonstrate to the Fish and Wildlife Service, so that we can take it into consideration moving forward with the listing decision, that the states are adequately building the structures to address the threats. So it's a little bit different on the Rocky Mountain side. They're focusing on fragmentation, and over here we're focused on wildfire invasives and doing what we can to keep the best of the best habitat largely intact. In April of this year, the Fish and Wildlife Service decided that the bi-state population, it's a subpopulation of the greater sage-grouse, it occupies about 4.5 million acres in Northern California and Northwestern Nevada. There's about three, give or take, 3,000 to 4,000 birds left in that population on a relatively small and relatively isolated landscape. And what led us to determine that species or that subpopulation was no longer warranted for protection was the planning effort that went into addressing the threats, smaller but very similar to what we're doing with the greater sage-grouse population. The plan that was put into place that led largely to the decision to not list that population was less of a federal and state planning effort and more of a partnership planning effort. They called it the Bi-State Population Action Plan, but almost exclusively like SageCon, it's a partnership that involves the federal agencies, the private landowners, the state agencies, the nonprofit, non-governmental conservation community, and everybody else who has a stake in the game. That action plan clearly outlined what everybody needs to do and how they're going to do it to address the threats, but it also brought in, over the next 10 years, roughly $45 million worth of conservation commitments. And so one of the take-home points from my presentation for you today is that what the Fish and Wildlife Service is doing with its current listing determination or status review of sage-grouse is that process does take into consideration what's changed since the last time we looked at it, which was 2010. But more importantly, it's a forward-looking exercise. And so what we're doing is taking into consideration the tremendous BLM planning effort, as well as each of the states' planning effort, and then the funding commitments that are critical to implementing what's outlined in all of those plans. Another thing that we've been able to do in Oregon is stitch together what we call this quilt of conservation that basically blankets the landscape through the candidate conservation agreements with assurances, and then the CCA, which is the candidate conservation agreement that applies to federal land. Essentially, what these plans do, it's a voluntary partnership agreement between the Fish and Wildlife Service and the private landowners, or mostly in Oregon's case, it's networks of conservation landowners. It's the Soil and Water Conservation District. And so if, just hypothetically, bear with me here for a moment, if you're a private landowner who has a 10,000-acre ranch and you do all the traditional ranching operations on your property, but the bulk of your grazing operation is on federal land, and the listing decision is staring you in the face, and that leads to a tremendous amount of uncertainty. What is this going to do to my ranching operation? What's it going to do to my grazing leases? If you enter into one of these voluntary agreements with the service, you negotiate a conservation plan that addresses the threats to sage grouse, such as they are represented on that particular property and your allotments. That may mean marking fences. It may mean putting escape ramps in stock tanks. It may mean limiting some of the predator subsidies like perch posts that golden eagles and ravens use, power lines, things like that, anthropogenic impacts to the landscape, maybe tweaking a grazing plan just a little bit, stocking rates, some of those kinds of things, working with the agencies to address the fire and invasive issue and those sorts of things, juniper control. And in exchange for implementing this conservation plan, you receive assurances that in the unfortunate event of a listing, you can keep doing what you're doing on the landscape because you've addressed the threats. The first, and you'll hear a lot more about this through our conservation partners from Harney County, but essentially there's just between 14 and a half and 15 million acres of sagebrush habitat in Oregon. We've covered that entire landscape with these voluntary agreements, starting with a 10 million acre agreement with the Bureau of Land Management that covers all of the BLM grazing leases or BLM grazing ground in sagebrush country in the state across 8 counties. Then Harney County, which was just under 2.3 million acres, I believe, of all the private land in Harney County. And then most recently this year, we expanded that to include the other 7 counties in partnership with the Soil and Water Conservation Districts. And in the next 30 days, we expect to complete the same kind of agreement with the Department of State Lands that covers all of their grazing leases throughout this entire landscape. It's another 633,000 acres, give or take. And so the foundation for this whole plan is that the inventory, the monitoring, the reporting, the conservation measures through all these plans are seamless. They're identical. So that if one landowner has one plan, he works with all the different cooperating agencies to do something that's value added to the landscape, to the community, to the bird, but is as easy to implement for everybody involved as possible. You'll also hear from some of the other speakers this morning about some of the funding commitments that the federal government has put into place to help implement these plans and what we hope to do in the future as well. With that, I'd just like to reemphasize that the service, our status review, the process that's taking place between now and the end of September, really is a forward-looking exercise. We're looking at how the states are addressing the threats, where the funding commitments are to implement the conservation plans that have been put into place, and re-emphasizing that we consider ourselves stakeholders in this process, too. If the regulatory environment results in a listing decision, a lot of the good work that we've been doing for the last couple of years with the partners on the landscape, the private landowners, the conservation community could be the listing determination. There's a lot at stake. Let's put it that way. Those are my comments. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much.
And Chair Witt, Brett Brownscombe, Fish and Wildlife for the record.
Yes.
So I think, Chuck, the next panel is from Harney County. So we have traveling over long distances, Marty Souter-Gould, Carol Dunton, Ray Sessler, and then Marianne Nash. We're hoping to present on the kind of rural community and livestock perspective.
Very good. Thank you. Please come forward.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Representative Esquivel. Senator Ferrioli know there's four people. He'll think it's a town hall meeting in the district.
Good morning, Chairman Witt and committee representatives.
Good morning.
I'm quite out of my element. I'm a rancher from Druzy, Oregon.
Well, welcome to our committee. And
thank
we
you.
Recognize that you have traveled a very great distance to be here this morning, and thank you for your appearance.
Thank you. Yes, it took us about 7 hours to get here.
Oh, my goodness.
We thought it was important. I'm a fourth-generation rancher.
And for the record, excuse me, would you please, before each of you testify, would you give us your name just for the record?
My name is Carol Dunton.
Thank you.
I am a fourth-generation rancher. And as Representative Bentz assured me, he has mentioned several times that we live in a big area out there. I do every day what's on the video. It interested me, and I just learned, watching that sagebrush shrink, it didn't shrink in eastern Oregon.
Yeah.
And I think that says a good thing. And we are in the core, we're in the little red area. Our private land and our BLM allotments and our Forest Service allotment. We operate approximately 4,500 acres of wet meadows and upland habitat, including lands homesteaded by my great-grandparents and grandparents. All of our private land is in this priority habitat area, and we manage a 400 commercial cow natural beef program on our property with U.S. Forest Service and BLM. We've had these BLM allotments since the Taylor Grazing Act went into effect in 1934. So we have a long history with those. And it's hard for me to understand, since we are in the core area and a focus area because we have sage grouse there, why we are going to be regulated possibly out of business by the BLM, because as Jeff mentioned, they're going to do some tweaking with our allotments and our grazing timing. If they take 2.5 months, delay our grazing permit, 2.5 months, that's going to cost us probably 50% of our herd, which will make it impossible for us to support the 8 people that we have depending on this ranch. It's very, very concerning to me. We've entered into the partnership with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on a CCAA, and I see that as a good thing, and we've had good dialogue with them. It's taken us 3 years. We've been on a committee 3 years to develop this plan. And I'm hoping to see that the Oregon plan coincides with, matches the CCAA plan. And we also developed a community alternative that we presented to the BLM when they were writing their RMP and ESI, I think it's called. I don't have all the lingo. But it was ignored, and I'm hoping that the Oregon plan can look at that and make our plan and the Oregon plan compatible, because we have some good ideas to us that will sustain our ranching operations, not just mine or ours, but all of those that are affected in this big sagebrush area. We traveled through 4 hours of that sagebrush.
Oh my goodness.
I worry about losing the legacy of our ranch. It'll affect a lot of things. It'll affect our family and a lot of other families at Ranch. Can you add anything, Brittany?
Yes. Chairman Witt, ladies and gentlemen of the committee, my name is Marty Suter Gould. I'm the district manager for Harney Soil and Water Conservation District, and I'm a third-generation Oregonian, and I've had the pleasure in my 42 years of life to travel and live across the West. And what continues to amaze me is the can-do attitude and the spirit of Oregonians and the ability and the privilege to be in a position that Soil and Water Conservation Districts have brought to Oregonians, to private landowners on 3.9 million acres of privately held land in Oregon, is an opportunity to demonstrate to the federal government and also be a role model for the West that collaborative grassroots conservation driven by landowners like Chairman Dunton here is the right solution versus regulation. And it is imperative today that we as a state, you as a public body, we as citizens that serve our people, is that we get this plan right. We get this plan right. We make it consistent. We are in a consistency review period. Our communities, Oregon, has provided some very good solutions that we have. Us cumulatively, the eight counties, the Soil and Water Conservation Districts, 1 million acres of private land out of the 3.9 million privately held acres that have come to us and said, we want in, we trust you, we have a local relationship with you, we know that you will work with us on these conservation measures to address threats that can keep us people, our legacies, like Carol's, in business so that we can maintain wide open space to contribute to the economic vitality of Oregon, the tourism, the future of our state, our great state, that has been gravely impacted by listing decisions such as on the table. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Good morning, Chairman Witt. How are you and the rest of you ladies and gentlemen this morning? My name is Ray Sessler. I'm the current president of Oregon Cattlemen's Association. I was born and raised in Oregon, lived here my entire life. I ranch in Crook County. I live in Prineville, about 20 miles out of Prineville. I ranch out in Palina, which is about 70 miles south, about halfway between Burns and Prineville. And I think the Oregon plan is quite good. I think we have a plan that's working. I think the state of Oregon is far ahead of other entities in planning for their sage grouse. Across the nation, there's been something over 4 million acres of ground processed in the seven western states. Recently, the Senate thought perhaps we might delay this for 10 years. I think that if you look around, you will see enough effort being done throughout all the states that we're making progress. And I think we need a little more time. The Oregon cattlemen have been really active in this. I couldn't begin to tell you how many sage grouse meetings people within the Oregon Cattlemen's Association have attended to the effect of working with ODF&W and everybody else that's involved. So I think we need a little more time to finalize the plan. The listing of the bird, I think, would be very detrimental to the livestock industry. I believe the Oregon cattle industry this year will approach $1 billion, perhaps more than $1 billion. And without agriculture in rural Oregon, and I know many of you are aware of that, what else is there? And I think we need all the support that we can garner to take care of that bird. Nobody's saying that we don't need to take care of the bird, least of all Oregon cattlemen. And I think going forward, there has been so much done. Fire is a huge thing in our little county of Crook County. We have a rural fire district, as many rural counties do. It's totally volunteer. They put out that little group. They have three little engines. They put out 37 fires in Crook County last year themselves. Totally volunteer, 100% volunteer. They get a few hand-me-down engines from the state or perhaps from federal allocation now and then. I think support for the rural fire districts would be horrendous. I think they could do a lot of good to this effort. Speaking for myself, my wife and I, we own 17,000 acres. We lease about 20,000 from the BLM. We have sage grouse. We lease another 80,000 acres from the Forest Service. We've been there 35 years. In 1983, we had 20 sage grouse. A month before last, ODF and Debbie came out. They've kept track of our sage grouse every year. We have 36 sage grouse, so we've got 8 more. And we have, at our own expense, we have cleared about 1,000 acres of juniper in the last 20 years, prior to any of this ever happening. Lots of ranchers out there have been whacking junipers long before we ever heard of the sage grouse, primarily because of water. But it helps the sage grouse habitat, too. We also entered into, with NRCS, in Crook County alone, by the end of this year, they will have taken out about 70,000 acres. On my ranch, we are in the final phase cutting today. They're cutting today. We will have taken out 3,800 acres of sage grouse habitat, cut the junipers on the sage grouse habitat. Every rancher in the community out there is working on this initiative, and I really think we're on the right track. Oregon is unique. We, as we all know, and we don't have oil wells to worry about. We have we've put the flagging on the fences, the little, you see the fences going down, they're little shiny things that looks like tin can lids to keep the birds from hitting the fences. Water has been developed. I think the industry and the state of Oregon has done a tremendous job addressing this issue, and hope for your support, and thank you.
Thank you so very, very much. Mary Ann, great to have you with us again.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, my name is Mary Ann Nash, here today with the Oregon Farm Bureau. And I am going to give a little actually personal background on this one, because this is actually, sage grouse is an issue that's really near and dear to my heart, because I was raised on a cattle ranch 30 miles east of Bend, right in the heart of sage grouse territory. My parents had about 300 head of cattle, 2,500 private acres, and over 100,000 acres of BLM and Forest Service permits. And sage grouse issues are actually what drove me to go to law school and want to advocate on behalf of farmers and ranchers. So it's an issue that's really important to me, and one where Farm Bureau and cattlemen and all of the farmers and ranchers across Eastern Oregon have done so much to help avert a listing because of the significant impacts that a listing would have on their economies. And so I'm just going to touch on, I think everybody's covered the issues really well, but a couple of big pieces that you heard touched on. As Brett mentioned, there's kind of two components going on right now. We're working on developing our state plan, and I've been sitting on the rule advisory committees for our state rulemaking, both at the LCDC and ODF&W level. While that's going on, BLM's been working on amending their resource management plans. Final draft of that was released, I believe, last week. And that's an area where both Cattlemen and Farm Bureau have been providing extensive comments on both, because those plans do need to fit together. And as Carol mentioned, it is so critical that the federal government listen and pay attention to what we have seen and what ranchers have seen on the ground in Oregon, what works for ranchers in Oregon in terms of management, to make sure that people are still going to be able to utilize both their federal allotments and their private land. Because for a lot of these ranchers, if they get cut out of their federal allotments, if their AUMs get reduced on their federal allotments, they can't make it on their private land alone, and they're going to be out of business just the same as if you had shut down their entire permitted, their entire private and public land. So for us, that piece is really critical. And while the state action plan, the state plan, is what will govern, you know, work on state lands, on private lands, the state's also been working with the BLM to try to make sure that those plans are cohesive. And we really appreciate the state's work on the, on those efforts. But I guess one of my big encouragements is, you know, the more that we can have a big swell of state support behind, listen to our ranchers, listen to the on-the-ground knowledge in terms of the resource management plan amendments. And one other the piece I wanted to mention is one of the reasons we've been working so hard on both the state plan and the resource management plan amendments is because there are always going to be groups that think that one way is better than another or that we're not doing enough. And the threat and concern over outside litigation is one of the reasons we've all been working so hard to develop a really defensible plan, and one that really is poised to work well and to actually ensure recovery of the species while maintaining working landscapes and while ensuring that the backbone of these rural communities remains intact. I know you, everybody in the legislature has heard time and again all session about how do we help our rural economies, how do we do more, how do we make sure that what they're doing, their lifestyle is protected and maintained. And for a lot of areas of southern and eastern Oregon, this is it. I mean, these are ranching communities. That's the primary staple of these communities, and we have to make sure that their livelihoods are protected, and have appreciated the state's work in listening to that voice and giving that voice a real seat at the table in developing these plans. And the one piece that I would really emphasize is that I think the governor's recommended budget around sage grouse, it's relatively modest. It's $4.5 million, but in terms of what we actually really need to see done on the ground, and as Brett mentioned, our state has devoted the least amount of money so far to these efforts. We just really need to make sure that that base level of money is there and is in place and is protected, because it's going to support the work of the Rural Fire Protection Associations. It's going to support work in removal of invasives, removal of juniper, and really making sure that we're giving the ranchers the tools that they need to be self-governing and to really ensure that their economies and their way of life is protected. And same thing with House Bill 2171. They're just really important measures to actually get some money on the ground and make sure that not only do we have this great plan in place, but that we have the resources to support that work and to make sure that that work can actually get done, because that's the best shot we have at preventing a listing. And just one final piece to avoid creating any confusion. Ray mentioned a potential 10-year delay in listing, and I just wanted to give some context for that. Congress is currently considering, as part of the defense reauthorization, a 10-year moratorium on a listing decision, essentially in order to give time for the state plans to be effective and to come into to really, you know, realize their potential. That would not stop the resource management plan amendments that we're talking about, that are the big piece that we really need to make sure fits in with our state plan. And that certainly would not stop the need, and it would actually increase the need, in my mind, for adequate state funding, adequate state protections to really show in that 10-year time frame that we are doing enough, so that we're not back in front of you in 10 more years saying, you know, hey, we need more, we want to do more. So I think that's, the to me, one of the biggest points that I wanted to emphasize is it's a relatively modest ask, but it's such an important one for these rural communities.
Thank you very, very much. Before we lose Representative Frederick here to other business, I think he may want to make a statement about our earlier introduction into some of this material.
Well, thank you, and thank you very much, Chairman Witt. I really appreciate you letting me do this. I have to head off for something else. We were, and pardon me, my voice is starting to go for some reason. I'm not sure why. We were lucky enough, there we go, to Spent some time in Harney County, 2013. Had a really good presentation there, not just in Harney County, but in a couple of other places as well. It is impressive to see the kind of coordination that's taken place without a lot of the name-calling that can be associated with it. It helps to not have that coming from either side. So I really appreciate this. What I am concerned about is making sure that we do, in fact, look at all of the aspects. The impact of water, the impact on the water is important because it also impacts the grasses that are growing or not growing there that we need to have growing there. The impact it was interesting to hear that attempt to deal with perching to make sure that the perches are not there for the raptors to attack the sage grouse and others as well. So I am I'm very pleased to see this kind of coordination, and it actually helps in my district where many of the folks could not tell you the difference between a sage grouse and the many chickens we have living in the chicken coops in my district. There's not much of a difference at times, but it is also good to see this kind of coordination, and so that when I'm talking with the folks in my town halls and I mention the sage grouse, it is something that I can talk about as a success that Oregonians are actually working together to try to make sure that we can get something done, and I'm very pleased to see it. So glad to see you folks from Harney County. I have met a couple of you, I think, before. It is one of my favorite places in Oregon, by accident to some extent, but I spent a lot of time in Harney County when I was a television reporter and ran around the different ranches and saw a lot of the county. The people there are the most resilient folks I've ever seen in my life. And so, again, thank you for bringing all the information here. And he should actually have something that would be a sage grouse sound rather than the crickets. Thank you again. Take care. Unfortunately, I have to leave.
Thank you, Representative Frederick. And I, too, want to thank you for your very, very powerful statements that you made here this morning. Truly important, truly critical, I think, to our understanding what's going on the ground for the Oregon plan. And Ms. Dunn, I want to assure you that every minute of your 7.5 hours return, you should be assured that you have made a difference.
Thank you.
Thank you all very, very much. Brett, can you help me stage manage here again, please?
Absolutely. Chair Witt, Brett Brown, Fish and Wildlife, for the record, and just to introduce the next panelist, or set of panelists, Judge Steve Grassi from Harney County is here, and he'll be coming up with Rich Angstrom, and I think Rich is going to talk a bit about what the mining community needs from the mitigation efforts, and hopefully keep it brief, along with Al Elkins and Amanda Rich will follow, and also hopefully keep it brief so we have time for conversation. But Judge Grassi has been a stalwart in this whole statewide planning effort, and I wanted to say just Judge, not cut you short at all, because I don't think there's anybody on the county end who's put in more time and effort into protecting the interests of counties. And he's put in, I don't know how many miles, going from one side of the state to the other in all of these statewide planning meetings, rulemakings, action plan, development, and what have you. And Judge, I wanted to really thank you for all of your effort in this. I know it's it hasn't been easy, but thank you.
Welcome to our committee, Judge. I think you came to us earlier by live feed from back home here several months ago earlier. Thank you for everything you're doing. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Witt. And for the record, I'm Steve Grassi. I'm a Harney County judge. Just to put that in context, I'm the Harney County Public Health Administrator, the Budget Officer, the Chief Administrative Officer, and usually I do HR. But in the context of today, what Brett just said is true. I can document over 3,500 hours I put into sage-grouse in the last 4 years, and I really think I'm over 4,000. Trying to lead the other six counties, what do we do with this? And I don't want you thinking I'm talking about county government. I'm talking about the folks that I work for.
Yes.
This young lady, Carol Dunton, back here, and Marty, I work for them, and 7,600 other people. And when Mrs. Dunton tells me I need to be doing something, I'm generally there.
I believe that.
I'd be there, too, if she told me.
Fairly important. So I found it surprising when she said 7 or 7.5 hours. I made it a little quicker than that, and I would have made it quicker, except one of Oregon's finest thought I shouldn't have been talking on my cell phone while I was driving. So,
but Your Honor, that was my bill, by the way.
Thank you so much. Let me give you a bit of background, as you've heard much of this, and then talk about the issue, and then I want to offer a couple of solutions as we move forward in this. There's really, in my mind, three things going on right now. Two of them are state things. Administrative rules are being written by ODF&W and LCDC. And then the BLM plan, the final EIS, has been released. So let me do administrative rules first. I don't know how many trips I've made or how many hours I've spent on the Rules Advisory Committee for each of those, and they're fairly well coordinated, but as I'm sure you know, you find it a little difficult when two agencies are told they need to use the same words. They find that very, very challenging to get there. I think they're going the right direction, or I wouldn't have been sitting at the table all the time. I've been incredibly frustrated representing counties as we've sat there and listened to trying to put together something that stops development. And I've asked a single question so many times in those two rulemaking processes that the folks that don't agree with me at all that are on that committee have started saying it before I can say it. And so if we're trying to limit development, what development? Somebody come into Harney County and show me what it is that we're trying to limit, because I'd kill for development today. So that's the first thing. And so you take those circles you saw on the map earlier and the core habitat, and you say, boy, we got to limit that to 3% development or disturbance. Well, first off, we still haven't gotten to what the heck disturbance is. So how do you measure 3%, or how do you measure a baseline and prevent us from getting there? So it continues to be a bit of an issue. It really is, from the community level looking at it, a bit of a lockup effort and controls. We've heard over and over, well, what if the county approves something? God forbid we'd have an opportunity to approve something. So I remained a little dubious on it. We're going to be at there. We're going to, as you've heard over and over, as a partnership, you got to be there and you got to work through the tough stuff. And we're getting there. We're gaining. I'm not convinced we're there yet. But overall, the SageCon plan is absolutely the right way that I think we ought to be going. You saw three big threats there that relate back to this that we're trying to write rules around. If this body can figure out how to introduce legislation that controls fire, weeds, or juniper, I admire you, and I'd like to know what those are. Carol Dunton and the people like her are the ones that are going to resolve this issue, and it's incredibly important that we keep them economically viable and on the land. Not up here in tears, and I've been in tears in this meetings myself trying to defend folks like her, that those are the people that provide the schools, they provide the infrastructure, they provide the workforce, and we got to have them there. And for this state, not just for Harney County, it's for this state, and it's the economic opportunity that brings us into the state. Brett asked me to talk a little bit about economics as I'm working through this. In 10 years, Harney County's lost 600 jobs. Again, tell me why I would want to get in front of development that might make 5 or 10 jobs on the ground when we lost 600 jobs. Not people, not workforce. We have 600 fewer jobs in Harney County, 22.2% of our work of the jobs are gone in a decade. No big ones. These are all onesie-twosies. We lose an opportunity here if we're not careful in generating income from the state lands, the blocks of state lands that are out there that put money into the common school fund. So another state issue. It is that one remaining economic opportunity, and we want to do what we can to protect it. And I want you always to remember something. The spotted owl was in seven Oregon counties, and it decimated the Pacific Northwest economy. We got lucky. We, the state, got really lucky because technology came in, and it turned the state's economy around. Didn't fix those communities, but it turned the state economy around, and we had a gain. This is 11 states. What do you think that's going to do to the national economy? And I don't know, but I encourage you to keep that in your mind as you think through the economic impacts that really haven't been considered completely yet. So let me talk to BLM EIS, because that's the next big thing. The governor has 60 days. That clock's already running 7-8 days into it to look at consistency between that rule and Oregon's rules. And a big one I look at, the most hated law in Oregon, land use, but it's also the backstop that kind of protects us. When you have a BLM rule, which is working towards a partnership agreement, there's no doubt about that, but when you have a rule that says wild horses are more important than the number of AUMs, cattle grazing, you have on the ground, I'm not sure that's consistent with Oregon's land use plan to protect farms and ag. Mm-hmm. So we have some fundamental issues that need to be resolved. Harney County government led six other counties to join in as cooperating agencies on the writing of the BLM plan. And that's where many of those thousands of hours I've got were invested in. SWCD, Marty put that many hours in as well into that plan, trying to do the same thing. And last December, that plan disappeared. We didn't see it anymore. It was gone. No more chance to have input until it showed up 3 weeks ago, and we got 2 weeks to report to review it. One chapter had gone from 298 pages to 363 pages. Substantial changes between draft EIS and final EIS, which personally I believe violates federal law. But what they did in it is locked up, and I'm exaggerating. I want to openly admit that on the record. But it locks up 1.9 million acres in Oregon. Now, there's nobody out there, three or four ranchers, so big deal, who cares, unless you're one of those guys. And all of a sudden, it becomes incredibly important. 1.9 million acres is the Columbia River coming up the Willamette, doing the entire valley floor to south of Eugene. Just to put that, the size of that. My recommendation, I hope the governor will back this up, they need to go back and do a supplemental and let the landowners out there, let us have some input into what it means to have these new sagebrush focal areas in there. And I'm hoping the governor and this body will kind of help us get that done. The plan's got to get in place or we're going to get a listing. So we got to keep that moving ahead. But I think we need some input into that, and I think we can modify the impacts of that. I've said one message all the way through this in all these hours. As long as we, Carol Dunton and those kind of folks, as long as we are part of the solution, we're okay. But when it becomes a top-down, I don't want to offend anybody in this room, so I'm going to make a comment about the system, and the ODF&W and U.S. Fish and Wildlife people in this room have busted their tail to find the right answer. But I'm going to tell you, when the gods of fish and wildlife push down on top, from top down, the solution, and we don't get to be part of it anymore, define the we, this body, Carol, all these folks, if we're not part of the solution, we are going to go away. We're going to fade out. And so as this moves ahead, I hope you help remember that and help that message. And I want to leave you with one final question to ask ODF&W every time you talk to them. This movement places them in land management. They say the right things, that know that they're only advisory. I agree with that. But their charge is critters. And I wish you'd ask every time, where's the plan to increase the population? We cannot find it. I haven't been able to get anybody to answer that question. And so there's a challenge you can use every time. Are there techniques that we can do on the ground, as we live in on the ground in our backyards, that will help increase that those population numbers? Because we'll be there to help. Somebody will help us, the biologists will help us tell us what it is. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very, very much. Welcome, Rich.
Welcome. Good morning. My name is Rich Angstrom, the president of the Oregon Concrete Aggregate Producers Association. I'm wearing the hat of the Hard Rock Miner. The mining potential in Harney and Malheur counties, where most of the sage grouse are, for the points of this discussion. One of the things I would, little known fact from my side, I think many of the committee know that I was a biologist and graduated from OSU as a fish and wildlife biologist, and I took particular interest in two species when I was there, the sturgeon and the sage grouse. And it's a very fascinating bird. I think, you know, we all kind of fall in love with its the mating ritual that goes along with it, and how the dominant males get to the center of the lac and the females have to work their way through the all those satellite males to get to the, you know, the chief dog in the middle. And I, as a student, I just found the whole thing fascinating. But the other thing that's might be of interest that gives me a little bit of legs to stand on this topic is I was appointee for the Steens Mountain Advisory Committee from the governor's no personal interest in what was going on out there and on the Steens Mountain as the Steens Mountain Act went through. And I was on it for quite a while until just the last couple of years I stepped down from it. And I can tell you that most of our effort was around looking at juniper encroachment. And then when this issue hit, the sage-grouse issue hit, we did multiple tours out there working with the ranchers and the environmental community looking at that issue, kind of reacquainting me with the issues, not just from the straight biology perspective, but, you know, the broader landscape perspective of what the ranchers and what the environmentalists' concerns were. And I bring that a little bit to this discussion because part of what the risk is, the balancing pieces, I think, are obviously the protection of this bird and what we do as a legislature to try to get Eastern Oregon back on its feet, the economic opportunities that are there. And you've heard me come in and talk a number of times now about comparing those counties with Humboldt County and why is Humboldt County doing so much better. They have a ranching community. They have the ag community. The only difference is they don't have the mining community down there. And that's the difference that's put Humboldt County in Nevada as one of the top growing counties in the country. And, you know, so the judge and other public officials down there really have a dilemma of trying to balance all of these things. We think the key and what we presented to you is the mining interests. And that doesn't mean when we put in a mine that we're going to put it in a way that we think should be, you know, harmful to the bird. In fact, we think we can help. But the things that we think that as we look at these core areas, the regulatory scheme is really based around the core area, right? And we think from the mining interests, what we need there is that's got to be a rebuttable presumption. The way those things came up is that they found the lex, they drew the two-mile circle, but they didn't consider all the geology and various interruptions that may mean that big parts of that core area may be open for development or open for mining and not have an impact on the bird. So as they work through the land use pieces, one of the things that we're engaged in is making sure that core area is a rebuttable presumption. We start out, that's the protection, but then with good science from like a mining company that comes in and shows that maybe there's a cliff or some significant geologic structure that breaks off the lek so it can't be seen from, say, the mining opportunity. And we ought to be able to present that as a way of kind of countering the core area. The other thing is that once we get through that hurdle, it's our belief that then the mine operator needs to either minimize or avoid the conflict. And if he can't avoid or minimize the conflict, then he needs to try to mitigate. And I think the big point, and I think the reason that Brett wanted me to talk, is, you know, one thing about mining is that we bring a certain amount of economic robustness wherever we land. A lot of family wage jobs. The minerals are actually very valuable, so the companies are pretty well situated to do mitigation. And we think that the trade-off ought to be that as we advance the mining interests, that we have a robust mitigation where we take care of some of the juniper-related problems in those particular sensitive areas. We go out and we, in order to get the permit, we restore, I don't know what the ratio would be, but some appropriate ratio for whatever the impact might be with the mine site. I can tell you, and this is our biggest concern, is that a 3% impact area, I'm not sure you can build a road into a sensitive area and not have greater than a 3% impact. We're really worried that as we find that balance between protecting the bird and trying to have some economic opportunity for those counties, that we're setting that level pretty low. With that said, we're going to continue, the mining industry is going to continue making sure that land use process works. Nobody wants to hurt that bird. It's not the most bright bird, which is part of the problem. It's just not adaptive, as us biologists like to say. But the thing that we can do is take care of the juniper-related issue. And no matter how you cut it, it comes back to the habitat degradation that's, in my view at least, my biologic view, is the encroachment and the proliferation of juniper. You know, interesting, we talk about fire as one of the problems now, but fire is what kept historically the juniper under control and kept it into, you know, the rimrock areas. And because now we're controlling fire, the juniper has taken over. The problem is now we got our area is so small, if it burns and it wipes out that sage habitat, it takes too long for it to recover. Right. And so we've created this really unfortunate circumstance with our own anthropomorphic, and it's not just the development activity, it's how we have managed the land over the years. You know, so but the big deal is for the juniper, and I just want to stress this again, it's the how it affects the habitat with its control of water. It's unbelievable what juniper does on the waterfront, and the perching for predators. I've been out there. I've watched ravens sitting on trees, on these juniper trees, scanning the ground. I've read the literature where other biologists have watched them literally follow the hen to the nest and then depredate on the nest. So, you know, we've created this problem. We can get ourselves out of it, but we got to do it in a way that keeps Eastern Oregon in a healthy economic state. So with that, I'd like to thank the chair for the time from the mining community. I'm relentless on this, and I appreciate you letting me come in and present our information to you.
Thank you both so very, very much. And Judge Grassley, before you leave, I can't tell you how many times as Chuck and I were looking at putting this hearing together, everybody would tell me, you got to get Steve Grassley over here. You've got to get him over here. And so I'm so pleased that you were able to make it. Thank you so very much, both of you.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, Brett Brownscombe, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. So the last panel, and we're a little over time, and I want to really, it's hard to not jump into discussion. Thank you all for the patience. But last panel, L. Elkins, Oregon Hunters Association, and Amanda Rich with the Nature Conservancy. If they keep their statements to 10 seconds, we should be fine.
Wonderful. Thank you. So great to have both of you before us once again. Good morning.
Our pleasure. Go ahead.
Sure.
Yep.
All right.
They'd much rather hear from you than me.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to present today. And I will be very brief because you've heard excellent testimony this morning on the full spectrum of the problem we're facing and the solutions that we are seeking. The Nature Conservancy, both here in Oregon and across the West, has made the restoration and conservation of the high desert ecosystem and the greater sage-grouse a top priority. And our work spans the spectrum from participation in planning groups and in countless hours in meetings, like you've heard about in the SageCon work, all the way to really groundbreaking work on restoration of sagebrush steppe and native grasses. So, you know, why do we care? Why do we spend the countless hours? Why do we hand make seed packets in a quest to get grass to grow in a post-fire system? We care because of the economic, social, and cultural reasons that you've heard expressed today quite eloquently, but also because this ecosystem is one of the most imperiled across the United States. And in addition to the grouse, there are another 350 species that are dependent upon this type of ecosystem that are at risk if we don't get this right. And the greater sage grouse, you've heard it called a canary in the coal mine and an early indicator of the health of the ecosystem. But it's also an umbrella species. And so we know that if we can do things right for the bird, that we will be helping all of the rest of those species and the ecosystem as a whole. So you've heard about the threats that we're trying to address. Conversion, fragmentation issues around land use, fire, and invasives. And you saw the list that Brett projected on the screen of the governor's recommended budget investments, and we are fully in support of those and believe that, as was said earlier, it's really hard to pass a regulation that makes, you know, fire stop coming or that makes junipers cut themselves. This takes on the ground, you know, boots on the ground type of work, and that takes investment and money, and it takes coordination and governance. We need to pass those rules, and we need to ensure an ongoing investment in a manner such as what was described in the Wild Bird and Community Investment Act that you heard Brett talk about earlier. So we very much appreciate the time this committee has spent, I think, more time than almost any committee in really understanding the details of this complex ecosystem and, frankly, the complex set of solutions that are needed in order to begin to address the problem. So we thank you for your time and your interest and your support.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Al Elkins with the Oregon Hunters Association. I have a number of things to talk about in relation to how OHA has been involved on the committee and everything. And everything that was said today has been said a lot better than we could say. We devoted a lot of time and money and effort, not nearly as much as other folks have, but in this last year, for example, we donated money to buy GPS collars to monitor the response of sage grouse to the catastrophic wildfires in Southeast Oregon. And then we had volunteers that helped put those on. But that's not, and I went over these 6 points with the people that I represent, the board, and they said that the message they wanted me to get to the committee today was one from the members that we have that are being faced with this problem, and that is that they need as much financial resource as they possibly can get on the ground. And so they asked me to ask this committee and its members for any type of influence you might have to help us with House Bill 2171. You saw it up on the graphic this morning. It would raise $2 to $3 million. Mr. Brett has polished it and it has amendments for all agree to. We've changed the name to make it a little easier to swallow, and that was Mr. Brett's effort as well. So we're all ready to go. All those people that you saw up there, we're all ready to go. We'd like to have a hearing, talk about what you heard today and why that financial resources is needed. Our members would greatly appreciate anything, any effort that you could give us, any help that you could give us on our effort to get that done. Thank you. That concludes my testimony. One other thing, Mr. Chair, if you ever want to fill a two-hour hearing, you get the volunteers that help collar those sage grouse at night in the desert. It will take 2+ hours to talk about their experience.
Thank you both. Thank you very, very much. And I just want to recognize your contributions, not only to sage grouse, and I include Rich Angstrom in this too, but sometimes lobbyists just don't get enough credit for the job that you do. And the three of you are here every single hearing. You're here for all of the work groups. You're here over and over and over again. You've provided leadership on the issues that our committee has dealt with time and again. Thank you ever so much for your dedication. It's
our pleasure.
It's a work of love, and it's palpable.
Thank you.
With that, I'd like to recognize Vice Chair McLean.
Well, I just don't want the people who came the farthest and have to leave to go home. I didn't want you not to hear what I had to say. I was really touched by your testimony this morning. And part of it is because this is such a big endeavor that it does take everybody. But it doesn't work unless the hometown folks are there to be the boots on the ground and to really give us the expertise that they have had from generations of ranching or farming or just living in the same environment as the sage grouse. And I just wanted to let you know that I feel a lot of I guess sort of optimism about this effort, because everybody in the room and everybody that was shown up there on the screen with the first presentation, it shows the endeavor of integration and the endeavor of commitment to keep everybody at the table. And sometimes the small tables and sometimes the medium tables, and then getting everybody together. And sometimes communication with groups that large, there are problems like the judge pointed out where you have an interim draft and then all of a sudden there's another draft and what happened in between. And I think we have to acknowledge that and really make sure that we're dealing with it. I was really glad to see that the soil and water conservation districts were involved so intimately, because to me those are also boots on the ground. And my very first experience with soil and water conservation districts came when I was 15, and I really feel like what I learned through that group was probably something that's kept me in good stead with many of the different types of things that I've dealt with over the years. But I want you to know that I think it's really important that we all continue as a state and as individual organizations and as individuals and staff and agencies and everybody else to just keep to our nose to the grindstone and just keep working on this, because we can't miss a beat. We've all been through these listings before. We understand the reason for the listings. We understand the reasons for the care. But we also have to understand that sometimes we get on a path that doesn't allow success for everyone, and success for the individuals in the community, for the landscaped, and or for the listing species that we're trying to help. So I just feel a lot of passion about this, and I'm also a fifth-generation Oregonian, and my great-great-grandmother's actually buried in La Grande. But I do want you to understand that I think if we keep this cordial conversation with all of the parties involved, that we will get there. And it's so important for all species. So thank you.
Additional questions or comments?
Is this just for this panel, or is it for the
I think for everyone at this point, okay. And we may actually call some of the previous witnesses back up again. So thank you, folks, very, very much. And this is we're going to have to jockey here a little bit, perhaps. But if everybody can help us make it work, it's going to work. Just like the Oregon plan, we're going to make that work too. Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for coming such a ways. I had the fortune when I was 8 or 10 years old to spend a summer on the Moon Ranch with my grandpa. He worked for Virgil and learned a lot, learned about how intricate the cattle industry is to that area and to rural Oregon. And everything they did was geared toward the cattle. You know, the haying, the bucking, the whole thing went toward the cattle. Also, when I was there, I remember seeing sage grouse fairly frequently, although, you know, they aren't thick, but you'd see them pretty regularly. I had the opportunity this last fall to go to Bob Smith's ranch, which is north of Burns, and he has about 6,000 acres there. We did not see one sage grouse. And I also noticed that next door on Bob's ranch, the BLM was taking out all of the juniper in the area, and they were cutting it, leaving it lay, cutting it. I don't know whether they were going to chip it or what they were going to do with it, but those are good steps, I think, because they didn't have the junipers when I was there when I was a youngster, but now you see them pretty frequently. The thing that I look at is a couple issues here. One is that where do we ever have the predator come into effect here? We've kind of skirted that in the respect of where is it in the plan? I see you have the wildfire, you have the juniper, and then you have the invasive species of grass. But where in that circle does the predators come? Because without a predator management, that's not going to work. And I don't see that. That wasn't presented here today. The other thing that I'd like to know is that I think that was a very good question. What are we doing in this plan to increase the population? We're talking about a defensive measure, kind of a Band-Aid type approach as far as I'm concerned, because I think we should be spending $20 million plus a year to take care of this situation, because one is it's going to shut down 40% of the state of Oregon, but more importantly, you could lose a species. And the last thing is I'm still against the hunting of that species. Why would you take 500 permits and allow 1,000 of them to be harvested for a few bucks on a species that's endangered, that may become endangered, and that may really hurt us? I don't get that logic. But anyway, those are the questions I have.
Anyone want to address the predator management component here?
Ron, let's...
Took Brett. Three of them. Took three
go
of
ahead,
them.
Brett, go ahead.
I heard three separate questions. Chair Witt, members of the committee, Brett Brown, Scott Morgan, Department of Fish and Wildlife. And so Representative Esquivel, I think... understanding those are consistent themes that you've made throughout every time we've talked about sage grouse, I think I want to assure you they're not being ignored. So the reason the issues around hunting and predation weren't highlighted in the presentation I gave this morning is not because they're not important or they're not in the plan. I wanted to just we had brief time, and I mostly wanted to save as much time as possible for those who came from afar. But the plan is deep. And amongst the threats, I stuck to the big three on habitat, wildfire. Actually, I had two, just juniper. I didn't really get into the invasive annual grasses. But the plan addresses those head-on as kind of the primary threats, because given where the science is on habitat, to get the response in the bird and the recovery of the populations of the bird, and I really appreciate your desire to see that, it's going to take work on habitat. That's not to say that other things aren't important, though, and so the plan does address hunting and predation along with other factors. We heard about the land use and development habitat fragmentation issue. But on hunting and predation, When I can walk through the plan section by section. There are two sections, one each on hunting and one on predation. On predation, it is recognized as, you know, there are populations, corvid populations, for example, that are growing around the West, including in Oregon, and a lot of the impacts happen in areas where there are perches or existing infrastructure that serve as perch or nest areas. The plan commits that where we've got that going on and an indication that that is driving down bird populations and preventing recruitment, that those locally identified areas would be priorities for addressing predation. And on the hunting issue, I think I'll turn that to Dave Badeau, but that is also addressed. We have a hunting season in Oregon. We believe it's amongst the western states, amongst the more restrictive already, and as a driver of declines of the bird, for reasons Dave can get into, it's not the driver that the habitat actions are, but we have committed to, and in part, I know you've highlighted this with a bill even, we have committed to making sure that if we've got trends over, you know, an 3 or 5 period time where in a management unit where hunting is allowed, the trends are persisting downward, we would address hunting. We would address the contribution of hunting to that decline by scaling back. So I they're not ignored, and Dave can probably get into more detail than I.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dave Badeau, and I'm the Upland Game Bird Coordinator with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And as Brett mentioned, we probably have one of the most conservative sage-grouse seasons within the range of sage-grouse, and there are 7 other states that hunt sage-grouse as well. We set an annual permit level, number of permits, based on what the fall population is expected to be, and we have a series of formulas we do that. Our self-imposed policy is not to harvest more than 5% of that fall population, and in practice it's usually much less, under 3%. The best science out there shows, or the guidelines say, that we should, to be conservative, should harvest 10% or less, and there was actually a recent paper that looked at banded birds in Nevada and Colorado, and they found that harvest rates up to 11% didn't affect the population. So the issue is, if we stopped hunting right now, we would not expect a year from now to be any more birds present on the landscape than with the hunting pressure that we have. And there's actually positives to hunting out there. And one of the biggest ones is that we gain biological information from this harvest that would be difficult or very expensive to obtain otherwise. It is a controlled hunt. We know every hunter. We provide each hunter with a collection package to provide us a wing from each bird that they harvest. And we get about 65% of the wings of the estimated harvest. From those wings, we're able to get a lot of information. We can get age ratios, sex ratios. We can backdate to time of hatch. We can actually even determine whether a hen was successful or not, just all based on the progression of the molt. So we get a lot of biological information from the harvest. So it's a positive in that way. And in fact, we just this year, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife published a technical report in conjunction with the state of Colorado that summarized over 40 years of wing data from Colorado and Oregon. And this is actually being used in the population models that are going to inform the Fish and Wildlife Service decision coming in September, some of the results from this. So we get a lot of information. We've actually had hunters collect blood samples over a 6-year period to monitor West Nile virus in Oregon as another threat. So we get a lot of biological information. Again, a positive. Another positive is you have a constituency that values the resource more. People that not only hunt sage-grouse but may desire to hunt sage-grouse in the future. And then there's certainly somewhat of an economic benefit as well. Is there any further question, follow-up?
Representative Esquivel.
Yeah, but see, what I'm looking at, what I'm thinking here is you've got something that may be on the endangered species list that then you won't hunt it at all. It gets listed. But you say it's for information, which I understand that to a certain point, but how long do you have to do this to get your information? I mean, how many years do you have to go to get this information before it becomes redundant? And the last thing I'd like to ask is, when are we going to reintroduce these example. Let's use Bob Smith's ranch. He has 6,000 acres out there. We haven't seen any. I did not see any sage-grouse there. Are we going to reintroduce those back in the area, or what are we going to do? How are we going to repopulate that?
Chair, Representative Esquivel, on that question, yeah, I think on, I mean, first on the hunting point, there's what Dave said, and the overall approach here is to avert an ESA listing and recover the bird. And that's, the plan is aimed at doing that, and the segments on hunting and predation.
Trust me, I love hunting.
As evidenced yesterday, I believe. The plan's actions on hunting and predation are aimed at ensuring that we've got a recovery trajectory and a turnaround. There are other ESA-listed species that we still fish or hunt, but the goal is to not get there. And that's why we have in the plan that trigger where if we're not seeing the population recover in a management unit over X period of time where it's being hunted, we will take action. For the reasons that Dave stated, it hasn't been elevated to the primary action that would be taken. On the other issue, relocations of birds have happened, and I know the department has been involved in some. The idea of hatching chicks and relocating them, however, has not worked, and I will not try to feign deep biological knowledge of this and turn to Ron and Dave on it, but the biology on trying to do a hatchery program with sage grouse has not worked the way it does with fish, for example.
Representative, I don't mean hatchery. I'm thinking is, can we capture some of these and take them and replant them elsewhere? Because I mean, it's, you know, I mean, there has to be some south of Burns or someplace else where we can take these birds and release them in areas where they used to be, but they aren't anymore.
Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel, that can be done, and actually there has been some success with trapping wild and birds and translocating. So if you have a suitable but unoccupied habitat, that can be an effective method. We've actually provided birds from Oregon to other states for some of their augmentation or introduction programs, most recently to the state of Washington, which has a highly fragmented, isolated sage-grouse population. We provided just this year some birds from Lake County, 40 birds, to the state of Washington for that kind of purpose. So it could be done in-state, too, if we have some suitable habitat that is unoccupied. That's certainly a possibility.
Vice Chair Krieger.
Just a statement. I'm going to have to run here in a minute, but there's a culture, a way of life that is experienced by our rural families. And they exhibit, if you get to know them, a stewardship ethic on the land because they understand that they want to pass it on generational to the next, you know, children, great-grandchildren on down the line. And I think they're willing to accommodate most of the needs of wildlife. They can accommodate that. They simply have to be given time to do it. And also, I think that if we do not give them that time and they have to leave the land, that will be the real disaster.
One thing, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please, Representative Esquivel.
Information on how you're going to repopulate this and on the predator predator control, I would like to have that so I can read it.
Yeah, okay. I'm happy to do that.
How about you, the rest of the, what do you think, the rest of the?
Yes, I think that would be very good. Thank you, gentlemen. I wanted to make a comment, too. I know that some of the things that were said here today, I wanted to make note of, and Marty Sudergeld, I hope I had get your name close anyways, told us how important it is to get the plan right. Such a simple statement, but so important. We have folks like Jeff Everett and his and the service. When they approve a plan, they've staked their future, their service's credibility on the fact that all of us are going to do our job in getting the plan right. And if we don't, his service and the Interior Department and everybody else gets sued. And so this whole thing is based on trust. And this is a two-way door. This door opens and closes. And I can't emphasize enough the importance that we heard here today of people working together on the ground at all levels. Something else that I heard repeatedly here today, and I think Ray and a couple of other people mentioned this. Steve mentioned it. If we don't have the people working this plan on the ground, and we don't have the faith, trust, and adequate resources, money, tools, implements, scientific guidance, we can pass all the laws we want. We can pass all the memorials. It doesn't get done. And I think the most important thing here is to remember that we've got to empower the people who are doing the job every single day, and we got to maintain that trust, and that trust is maintained by communication, that voluntary association of people working together trying to make this plan work. And I cannot encourage enough that continued communication, that collaborative approach, these voluntary associations. This is where this plan is going to work. And to the extent that that our colleagues in our federal departments are willing to move forward with us and enable us to make these plans work, sir, I thank you on behalf of the service and everyone else who's enabling these good folks to continue the good job that they and their families for generations have been committed to doing. With that, this committee stands adjourned. I want to thank everyone for the absolute excellent testimony that was provided here today. And I wish each and every one of you who have come 7.5 hours a very safe return. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.